tonight on Arena. Ciarán Hinds returns to the city of his childhood in Kenneth Branagh's Belfast, and alongside that film, we'll be reviewing Nightmare Alley and Mass. Five one double 51 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. The actor Ciarán Hinds started out in university studying law, but lucky for us, he abandoned his studies at Queen's University Belfast to enrol at RADA. A stellar career on stage and on screen, on television as well, has followed. Most recently, of course, he played the manipulative drug kingpin Eamon Cunningham in Kin on RTE One television. But now he's back on the silver screen in his native city, in Kenneth Branagh's Belfast, where he's playing Pop, the kind-hearted grandfather of nine-year-old Buddy. Belfast, the film, is a fictionalised memoir of Branagh's childhood and depicts the dramatic times that lead up to Buddy's family deciding to take up sticks and leave their home city as the Troubles kick off there in 1969, events that have real-life echoes in Kenneth Branagh's own childhood. His family moved from Belfast to Berkshire when Branagh himself was nine. Ciarán Hinds has already been nominated for a Golden Globe for Best Supporting Actor for his work on the film, and who knows what else may follow when Oscar nominations are revealed on the 8th of February. I spoke to Ciarán earlier on today, and I began by asking him just how familiar was he with the world in which the film is set?
I guess I was very familiar with it. I was 16 at the time it was set in my own hometown of Belfast. The event that he's talking about, that Ken sets it, is the 15th of August, as I remember, 1969. And we would have been on holidays then in Cushendall, County Antrim. So we got reports of what was happening in Belfast at that time. My father, who's a doctor, was also in the city, still working, and he was warning us not to think about coming back at that particular moment, because things were quite hot. And and from then on, it got hotter and hotter. And,
In fact, didn't you live not more, maybe a mile and a half up the road from where Kenneth Branagh grew up?
But it was probably less than a mile, John. It was like three quarters of a mile. Cut between the half mile and the mile. And it was the same area as the Cahill Road in North Belfast. And he was in the Limestone Road just below us. Yeah. And I went to school opposite where he lived. And we never met.
Yeah, you were a bit older than him for one thing, but also you were in the Catholic side of the community. He was on the Protestant side of the community. Would that just have meant that there was never a chance that you would have met?
Basically, yes, because of the segregated education. That's why the integrated education movement is so important now in the North. But I was fortunate. I was able to mix with Protestants as a Catholic through Irish dancing or a bit of drama lessons or something. But if you didn't have that outside, you were just, from the age of four, separated. Each child, the Catholics and Protestants, being educated differently.
And of course, your father was a doctor and dealt with patients. You were right on the dividing line. He dealt with patients on both the Falls Road and the Shankill Road. So he was seeing patients from both sides of the community. There was no division there.
No, not for when you take the Hippocratic Oath. You're in all the way. He did the surgery. He had was in the Springfield Road, which was away from our home, which is about 2 miles away. But it was basically most of his patients were between the Falls and the Shankill. And he treated them as you would as a doctor, irrespectively of what tribe you were in.
How would you characterize Pop as we meet him? What Buddy calls Granda, he calls him Pop. How would you characterize your character, Ciarán?
I guess, like some of my forebears, kind of rather stoic and with a wry sense of humor and genuine love of family, and probably in his youth a bit of a scamp himself.
Did you have a model for that, would you say, in either your father or your grandfather?
Well, I didn't see them in their youth, but I imagine they came back to haunt me while I was actually playing the role.
In fact, I think there was a moment when you put on the costume when there was a almost, it sounded as if it was a haunting when you put on Pop's clothes for the first time.
Yes, it was kind of a strange experience, Sean. Charlotte Walter, who's a wonderful costume designer, I had never met her before, and she said, come up to this place somewhere in Hendon in North London, we'll try some clothes on you. And it was COVID time, so we were all masked up. But she'd selected some things, and bit by bit, I tried them on. And after about three tryings of jumpers or trousers and cardigans or shirts, I started to realize I had suddenly become a mixture of my father and my grandfather. I don't know how she felt it or sussed it out, but certainly the colors, the schemes of the design, and also the material itself. Mm. It was, so, and then I guess the older we get in life, the more we start to go back, yeah, be reminded of the spirits of our forebears, and I think that might have had a part to play as well.
Yeah, I guess it must have been an emotional moment in that respect.
It was, because those memories, especially for the people who are gone that you were close to, suddenly are brought back straight in, right into focus. You know, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you always have them with you. They appear in your mind, haphazardly. But this was suddenly more present than it had been for a while.
Let's listen to a clip from the film. And at this point, young Buddy is besotted with a little girl at school, and he's looking for advice from Pop and Granny. Pop, played by you, Ciarán Hinds. Buddy, played by Jude Hill. And Granny, played by Judi Dench.
Be careful what you wish for. Is that the minister of the wee mission says?
When is your next chance?
We have to do a project about the moon landing.
But did those boys not come back from that?
They did. Now we have to cut things out of the papers and explain how they got there.
If they did get there, they did get to the moon. It's not what it says here. God doesn't like it.
And I watched every night too that they were up there. And how did I never see Mike Collins in the mothership doing his orbit? Surely you would have seen the sheep of Columbus against the light of the moon.
No, that's because mostly he was on the dark side.
Exactly, it's the side that Lucifer hangs his shillelagh.
No, he was on the dark side of the moon most of the time, where we couldn't see him. You know, when he was doing his orbit, and then maybe, you know, just before he was due to come around the corner, you had to go in for your tea.
If I could come up with something smart about that, maybe I could stay up at the top desk and wait till she gets back there.
Or you could say the moon's made of green cheese and dropped down a place.
Or you could do the project together, you and the young lady. You get the same marks and maybe end up on the same seat together.
But how do you even talk to her?
How do you handle a woman? There's a ways and a ways, old man. A way known by every woman since the whole rigmarole.
Yes, old rigmarole with you, mister.
That's a great Belfast word at the end. Well, an Ulster word at any rate at the end of that clip, Ciarán Hinds, and yourself, Judi Dench and Jude Hill from the film Belfast. Rigmarole. Lots of that kind of authenticity in there. Was that an attraction when you read the script first?
Yeah, some of that's kind of stuff, rigmarole or rigmarole. Sometimes they're slightly improvised off the script, although the script is so brilliant and so lucid and authentic that we stuck to it. There might have been tiny little tweaks or offerings up from the actors, but mostly we just stuck with Ken's script. But he had words in there like, Ulster expressions like, I take the hand out of you, and... other stuff that doesn't come immediately to mind, but he didn't shy away from using local idiom,
yep,
and imagine that people could understand what it meant.
Of course, Adrian Dunbar has made that his own now in Line of Duty, hasn't he? The Ulster idiom.
So. Him and his wee donkey. Yeah, apparently.
And several others along the way as well. The film screened in Belfast just before Christmas. What did that feel like? Obviously, for yourself, Jamie Dorn, Kenneth Branagh, yeah, very much connected with Belfast, others in the cast as well, with big connections in and around that area. What was that screening like?
It was hugely emotional, really. And when you go into something like that, you realise you're offering up this film entitled the name after the town. It's going to open its film festival. It's going to play in the Waterfront Hall, which was held about 1,600 people. And Ken Branagh, being the brilliant man he is, made the most wonderful speech beforehand. He didn't go on at length, but he was so inclusive in everything he said. And then you hold your breath because it's like, you know, in Belfast, you're going, this could go either way. People take it to their hearts and they go like, what are you talking about? And the fact is, it seemed that people were genuinely thrilled and touched by the whole event.
No, and I'm sure they would also tell you what they felt about it immediately afterwards as well, I'd be sure.
Well, exactly. What do you call that?
Exactly. And, or some such phrase.
Just to point out the brilliant Katrina Balfe.
Of course.
Who's from your neck of the woods.
From Monaghan, of course.
Monaghan, it is phenomenal in this in this film. Yeah. I mean, not beyond, she has her own beauty, but her truth and her performance is something really to behold. And then, of course, you have this extraordinary young fella, Jude Hill, the age of 10. and Judi Dench and Jamie, to be in such great company, to be quite honest.
Well, isn't
to be guided.
Gagged by Kenneth Branagh. Isn't it brilliant that the ensemble has been nominated for the Screen Actors Guild Award? But those nominations, particularly the ensemble one, I think would speak to you as the theatre man, Kieran.
Yeah, they do. Yeah. That idea of the shared work, our shared responsibility for storytelling. I mean, of course, there's some individuals that come to the fore, but I think there's nothing more gratifying. And it is great when the people understand that through the work, the shared work, that we've actually somehow been able in the film to encapsulate the kind of the ethics of family life.
Well, listen, Kieran, great to be speaking with you this evening. Hope it all goes well. Good luck with all of the awards, whatever way they go, and hope to see you back in this neck of the woods soon. Didn't get a chance to talk to you about Kane and Eamon Cunningham, but it was another great performance. Thanks, and great to speak with you, Kieran.
Great to hear you, Sean. Take good care now.
Well, indeed, that's Kieran Hines. And let's finish with another clip from the film. Jude Hill, who Kieran mentioned there in that interview, who plays the young buddy. Kieran Hines as Pop here. And Pop is finding out that the family are thinking of moving to England, and that brings up all sorts of memories for him and all sorts of potential difficulties.
Mama says if we went across the water, they wouldn't understand the way we talk.
That shouldn't be a problem, son. I've been married to your granny for 50 years. I've never understood a word she said. And if they can't understand you, then they're not listening. And that's their problem. You know, when I was in Leicester, they said the same thing about me. You know, so I put on a different bloody accent every day just to annoy them. They never knew who it was. But I did. And that's the only one who needs to know. You know who you are, don't you?
Yes, Pop.
Your buddy from Belfast 15. Where everybody knows you. And your Pop looks out for you. And your mommy looks out for you. Your daddy looks out for you. Your granny looks out for you. Your brother looks out for you. And the whole family looks out for you. And wherever you go and whatever you become, that'll always be the truth. And that thought will keep you safe. It'll keep you happy. You remember that for me?
Yes, Pop.
Aye, fine man you are.
Buddy from Belfast 15 there, played by Jude Hill, and his grandfather, Pop, played by Kieran Hines, who was speaking to us before that clip, speaking to us about Kenneth Branagh's film Belfast, which will be in cinemas from tomorrow, and indeed will be the first of our film reviews in just a couple of minutes' time. We'll be talking about it, as well as Nightmare Alley and Mass. 22 minutes past 7 on Thursday night, Serena. Lovely text came in just as that interview was finishing with Kieran Hines. This is from Marion Rees in Artane in Dublin. Dr. Hines, I presume a reference to Kieran's father, brought me into the world and also treated my children. A most wonderful man. Kieran is so like his father. I'm sure he would love to hear that. And as he said, when he put on the costumes, he felt a bit like him. So Thursday evening, as always, it is our movie evening, and we will be talking, reviewing Kenneth Branagh's semi-autobiographical film Belfast, released this week. We were just speaking to Ciarán Hinds. The film chronicles the life of a working class Protestant family and their young son's childhood during the troubles of the late 1960s. Nightmare Alley is a neo-noir psychological thriller directed by Guillermo del Toro. It looks at an ambitious carnival worker with a talent for manipulating people. He hooks up with a female psychiatrist who is even more dangerous than he is. Bradley Cooper and Cate Blanchett, among the leading cast there. And Mass, where the grieving parents of a victim of a school shooting agreed to meet the parents of the perpetrator 6 years after the tragedy. This is the directorial debut from Fran Kranz. With me this evening to talk about the films, Ruth Barton and Michael Pope, and they've just been to the virtual cinema for us, and we'll start with Belfast. Obviously, I mean, we got a sense of what the film was about, Ruth, from when we were speaking to Ciarán Hinds beforehand. But this is Buddy's story, the little boy. This is a very personal story of film from Kenneth Branagh, set in his hometown in August 1969, very early days of the trouble, and maybe a side of Branagh that we forget about, these Belfast origins. Do you think what story is he aiming to tell us here, do you think, Ruth?
Yeah, I'm really interested that he came home to make this film. And I think my guess is he said he made it during lockdown because he should have been working on other material, but then he had a bit of time in his hands. And I was, you kind of imagine we've all reflected a bit during lockdown. And that this was a moment for him at his age and at his point in his career where he's a very successful director to look back and think, how did it start for me and where did it start for me? Mm. And, it'll be very interesting because we know he's from Belfast, but I expect most of his admirers would have thought of him as English and assumed, if they'd ever thought about it, that he came from England.
Yeah.
So it's very interesting that at this point, and maybe it's part of the kind of post-Troubles environment, that he feels safe enough, in a sense, to go back to Belfast, both metaphorically and actually physically.
Mind you, Michael Pope, the Belfast of 1969 is certainly not the stuff of fairy tales. Branagh, he gives this film a nostalgic glow, aided and abetted along the way by the music of Van Morrison and a few other aspects. But it's not gritty Northern Ireland that we're getting here, is it?
No, it's quite a gorgeous view of kind of quintessential late 1960s life in Belfast. He uses his regular cinematographer, Harris Zamburlicus. It reminded me a lot stylistically of Alfonso Cuarón's Roma from a few years ago. It's got these gorgeous wide angles. It is a black and white, obviously.
Yeah.
These gorgeous wide angles. It's got this warm, intimate detail. And it does actually have kind of a fairy tale edge, I found. It's very kind of a child's view, child level view of this kind of world. And especially when you've got such a comical and kind of charismatic leading performance as you do have from Jude Hill, it's kind of, it is a lot funnier than you'd expect, even though it is, semi-autobiographical about, the rising sectarian animosities and violence. But it's definitely got a kind of a lush, beautiful quality to it that is, I'm sure it's his story and it's his life.
Yeah,
so I'm not going to start saying, why didn't he, where's my verisimilitude?
Yeah,
but I do think that...
The other side of that is that, as Michael says, Ruth, it is in black and white for the most part, but every so often you just get splashes of colour, which kind of suggests these are, I suppose, the things that lit up the imagination of the young child, most of them either in the theatre or when he's watching films.
Yeah, and this is a story that is almost told through films. There's like a kind of secondary way of telling the story, which is through a series of film clips, many of them of Westerns, and so you've got the good guys versus the bad guys. But also I think this is, again, Branagh saying, how did I grow up?
Yeah.
How did I get inspired? I got inspired by movies lighting up my life in a way. Although, as Michael's saying, it's a very aestheticized black and white. And the opening is almost like a musical, I felt, with the characters kind of moving around in a kind of almost stage-like way, and then the Van Morrison song over that opening sequence.
Cinema does play a huge part in the way the story is told. And in this clip, we get a real sense of that. Buddy, played by Jude Hill, looking forward to his father returning from work. The father goes to England every Monday,
money,
he's away for a fortnight or maybe 3 weeks at a time, then comes home with the money. But the plan is that the family are going to go and see Chitty Chitty Bang Bang at the cinema. And Buddy, played by Jude Hill, wants his granny, Judy Dench, to come along with them.
Has your father said what he's doing?
He says it has to get decided by Christmas.
When's he coming back?
At the weekend. We're going to the pictures. He's taking us to Titty Titty Bang Bang.
What in the name of God is that?
It's a flying car.
Oh, God, I've heard it all.
It goes over a cliff and you nearly fall out of your seat. Do you want to come? It'll be company for you till my pop's home.
If God had wanted me to see flying cars, I'd have been born with blinking wings. You love your films, don't you? I was a great one for the pictures when I was your age. I used to think you could climb right inside the screen and visit all those strange places you saw. Like that one in that film, what was that? Lost Horizons. Do you ever see that?
No. What was the name of the place, Granny?
Shangri-La. That's what they called it.
Jude Hill and Judy Dench there in a scene from Kenneth Branagh's Belfast. The other aspect, I suppose, Michael, where we get a kind of verisimilitude, if you like, or a more realistic line to things, is around the fact that the father, played by Jamie Dornan, and the mother, played by Katrina Balfe, they're in real financial difficulty.
Yeah, Pa and Ma, as they're named on screen and in eye literature. Yeah, Pa's in trouble with a tax man, so he's back and forth to the UK for work. He wants to make the move there permanent. Ma is kind of having none of it. She's kind of even under the threat of intimidation from all these local thugs and looking for money and Protestant loyalty and stuff. It gets quite serious, especially when Buddy's trying to deal with all this stuff. But you do have stuff like that kind of a colourful, fuzzy banter from Granny. Mm-hmm. Judy Dench and Pop there, as you had on Kieran Hines, they've seen it all and then some. Like, so even when things get kind of heavy and, you know, kitchen sink drama kind of gets overbearing, there is a Van Morrison song every 5 or 10 minutes to kind of, like, you know, just keep things light and keep spirits high. Believe me, if you like Van Morrison, this is right up your alley.
Yeah, but that sounds as if did you find that it was there a kind of a repetitive nature to that Van Morrison is the way out of the trouble?
There's kind of a loop it kind of gets into, even though it's got kind of a refreshingly kind of lean running time, especially for like awards fodder. Isn't basically 90 minutes. But there's kind of, it kind of does kind of get to a point where it's like they're in trouble, dad comes home, kitchen sink argument, wisdom from grandparent, high school sweetheart, and then Van Morrison, and then kind of repeat that for a while, which is fine. It's a beautiful looking film and it's got a warm heart, so you wouldn't begrudge it that. But, you know, there is a kind of a slight repetitiveness that kind of creeps in.
All right, let's listen to one more clip. Ma and Pa, as you mentioned there, Michael, played by Katrina Balfe and Jamie Dornan, respectively. And you get a sense here of the financial difficulties and the era in which the film is set.
We were running around here like the man in the big picture, not paying your taxes and spending all our money on horses.
It's the building trade. I told you it doesn't work the normal way. I told you I had it covered.
I was the one who had it covered.
No, you had to spend 3 years of back tax.
Keep you out of bloody jail. We're drowning in debt.
We're near done with the back tax. £10 a month for 3 bloody years. This is the time to think about making a new start.
I know nothing else but Belfast.
Exactly. There's a whole world out there. We can give these boys a better chance than we ever had. There's Commonwealth countries needing tradesmen. The government will give you assisted passage. We can get the whole family to the other side of the world for £10. We're living in a civil war. I'm not here to protect my family.
Katrina Balfe and Jamie Dornan there in a scene from Belfast. So, Ruth, all sorts of talk about, obviously it's an A-list cast for starters. Katrina Balfe as Ma there, Jamie Dornan, Judy Dench as Granny, Kieran Hines as Pop, and this young Jude Hill that they're all talking about.
Fantastic, gorgeous kid.
Is this heading, there's all sorts of talk about awards. Is it heading for awards?
Oh, it's got awards written all over it. I mean, as you say, the cast, the look, but also that kind of warm sentimentality, which is, it's not a political film, it's a coming.
Does that matter?
Not at all, because you come out of the movie feeling good about yourself. And just right now, that's what people would really give a lot of money for, or certainly the price of a cinema ticket for. So I think, given the profile of Branagh, giving the kind of, you were talking about the ensemble acting, which I think really, really works in this. And I think people will overlook the kind of basically lack of narrative tension in favour of the kind of mood that it invokes. So, yeah, I see awards coming its way.
And what is it getting in terms of that? I think you enjoyed it, Ruth, from what you're
saying.
I did.
I mean, I kind of pick it apart and you find things wrong. But just that moment leaving, I felt, I really enjoyed it. So 4 out of 5 for me.
4 out of 5. What are you saying, Michael?
I'll go for 3.5 out of 5. I was a 3, but there is a really beautiful coda at the end, which really got me right there. So, yeah, I'll go 3.5 out of 5.
I think it's a dance sequence that you loved as well, Ruth, at the very end.
I love that dance sequence. You can just pick it up on YouTube, too. It's all over the place. Yes,
you'll get it there. All right, that's Belfast. Let's move on then to film number 2 this evening, Nightmare Alley. Guillermo del Toro takes us down Nightmare Alley, literally, with Bradley Cooper as the doomed Stanton Carlyle, originally played by Tyrone Power in the 1947 version of this film. And Ruth, it's a film based on a novel.
It's a film based on a novel, so it's not a remake. Del Toro has been very clear. It's not a remake of that 1947 movie. He's gone back to the novel with his then partner, now wife, who he co-wrote this with, Kim Morgan. And so, it's very, very much, he's put his own mark on it too. It's very much a Del Toro film. And anybody who's seen, any of his early work, like Kronos, or more recently, The Devil's Backbone, Pan's Labyrinth, and of course, most recently, The Shape of Water, will see his trademark image making all over it. Because although there is quite a long and relatively complex story about this grifter, played by Bradley Cooper, who starts, we see him burning down his house, and there's been a murder in the background, and that all emerges. But it's really about him running away to the circus, and he goes to this carnival. He rocks up. He's got very little possessions, very little going for him. He starts off in quite a menial job, but he very quickly kind of insinuates his way into the heart of the carnival. He tricks the mentalist, which is somebody who does kind of mind-reading skills, mind-reading performances.
Is that the Toni Collette character? She's the mind-reader.
She's the mind-reader, but she does it in partnership with her husband, Pete, who's David Strathairn, who I love. I think he's always fantastic on screen. And so they have this long-running partnership where they basically, through a set of kind of cues, they pretend they can read people's minds. And they sort of can get something off people as well. Yeah. That's part of what this story is about. So he tricks his way into the kind of confidence.
And finds out how they trick people into their confidence.
That's right. So there are a lot of confidence tricks. Yeah.
All right. So we were talking, Michael Pope, about the look of Belfast in that black and white film from Kenneth Branagh. And Ruth has touched on it there in terms of images and Guillermo del Toro. The look of this film is hugely important.
It is. I mean, I know, as Ruth was saying, it's kind of standard for a Guillermo del Toro film to look wonderful, but this is remarkably, in every respect, even the grotty carnival where kind of Stanton kind of finds himself as a drifter, to this ballroom where he ends up with Molly, played by Rooney Mara, where they reinvent themselves as this kind of psychic act for the wealthy urban elite. And even Cate Blanchett as the doctor, Dr. Lilith Ritter, she's kind of a skeptic and kind of a psychologist. Her high-rise Manhattan office is ridiculous looking. It's so beautiful. The costumes by Louis Aguirre are gorgeous. The photography, which is by Dan Lawson, he's kind of Del Toro's usual go-to guy. It's almost worth the price of admission alone. And I do suggest, if you can, see it on the big screen, because it looks gorgeous and it sounds gorgeous. We'll get to what I didn't like about it, but in terms of presentation. And sometimes, that's okay. I just, like, a lot to be said for us shallow types who just love looking at incredible movies with lots of movie stars that look amazing. It is sleazy. It is old-fashioned, but it's also a big budget Hollywood film noir, and I love that.
Yeah, and for sure that's there in the casting. You've already mentioned Ruth, Rooney Mara, David Strathairn, Willem Dafoe is in there, Toni Collette is in there, Cate Blanchett and Bradley Cooper. I mean, that's quite a cast list. And let's listen to a clip which features Cooper and Blanchett. Stanton Carlyle calls to the office of Dr. Lilith Ritter, and this really is, the pot calling the kettle black is what's going on here. Remember, he's the con man, she's the psychologist.
Mr. Carlyle, come in.
Slow day.
Have you not heard? We're at war.
I'm aware. How did you know it was me?
What brings you here?
You left me your card, didn't you?
So, here we are.
Oh, not me. I never drink. Microphones.
That's right. Wire recorder.
You recording this?
No. My office is wired to record all analysis sessions.
You got a smoother line, but you run a racket. Same as me.
Is that what this is?
Kate Blanchett and Bradley Cooper there in the scene from Nightmare Alley. Blanchett, she even sounds film noir in that clip, Ruth. She really is made for the drawl that she has, the way she looks in this film. She's made for film noir.
She is. She could have been any of the Spider Women of, you know, that kind of 1946, 47, 48 cycle of post-war anxiety films where a woman, you know, he should have seen it coming because she is the woman who's going to trick him. And she's, you know, as Michael said, she looks fantastic. She's got a gash of red lipstick across her mouth, and she dresses beautifully. And it's a fantastic role for Cate Blanchett. But of course, she's not real, and nothing in this film is real. And it's a, you know, it's about this sort of idea that seeing is believing, but of course, seeing isn't believing because what you see is never really what's going to happen.
You told us all the things you liked to start out, Michael. I will allow you now to vent what it was that bothered you about the film.
Well, it's just, I think it's really Bradley Cooper as Stanton. Either his take on the character or how he portrays it, it just isn't that charismatic presence. I mean, I kind of need, you in this kind of film needs him to be kind of a roguish anti-hero in a sense, not to be totally sympathetic, but I do think that if you think back to Double Indemnity, Billy Wilder's Double Indemnity, and you think of Fred McMurray in the lead role, he's a bad guy and he's up to no good. But I love spending time with him. He's doomed and he's a rascal, but I love spending time with him. I think Cooper's performance is missing that even from the start. It's like Rick Root said, he walks away from a burning house that he's just put that he's left a kind of a corpse in. And you're kind of thinking, well, this guy's got a lot going on. There's something, some sort of angst here. And they allude to that, but it doesn't really come across. You don't really get to know him. You certainly don't really get to like him, people like him, which is okay. But by the end, kind of wanted him to get what he deserved, really.
Yeah. And were you in a similar boat, Ruth? I don't think you were quite as down on it as that.
No, I mean, I just thought, actually, quite frankly, I thought the movie was too long. It's two hours, 40 minutes, and it could have lost 30 minutes, particularly towards the end. It's almost like two movies. It's a movie of two parts, and both those parts are too long, as much as you enjoy the visuals. I thought the way that he was filmed, he's kind of filmed in a sort of fragmented way. You see pieces of him, which is what we get as well as this kind of fragmented character. So that didn't bother me too much. It was really more the fact that it didn't really hang together. The ending is signaled from the beginning.
Right.
And also it doesn't have like that power. I thought, you know, when you watch The Shape of Water, it was all about reversing the Beauty and the Beast story, and it was a very modern take on myth. But this, because it's got its origins in that period, is really quite an old-fashioned film in many ways.
And so stars from you, Ruth?
Well, I gave it 3.5 because I thought the visuals were fantastic.
3.5 for the visuals. And what are you saying, Michael?
I'll go for 3.5 as well, yeah.
Right, so kind of middle of the road, 3.5 is what it sounds like there from both of you. Let's move on then finally to Jason Isaacs and Martha Plimpton playing the parents who have lost their son in a high school shooting 6 years earlier. The film is called Mass. It's the directing debut of actor Fran Krantz. Mass opens in a bare Episcopal church hall somewhere in the US. We're kind of presuming here in studio that the Mass is a reference to Massachusetts here. Two sets of parents are about to meet, Michael. It's almost like the setup for a play, this, because there's very little movement, certainly for a large amount of time, other than the four people sitting at a table talking to each other.
Well, not in a derogatory way, but I would class it for most of its runtime as a filmed play. I mean, there's only so much I can really synopsize this film. It's set in a church basement. There's two couples, as you mentioned, played by Martha Plimpton and Jason Isaacs, are the grieving parents of a victim of a school shooting, and Anne Dowd and Reed Birney are the parents of that perpetrator. And they basically meet to discuss for the runtime, to discuss and try to reconcile this inconceivable tragedy. So it's 6 years later, and they both have kind of different demeanors, certainly.
Yeah. Let's listen to a clip which gives us a sense of the dynamic that is in the room. As you say, Jason Isaacs as Jay Gale, played by Martha Plimpton, they're the parents who have lost the child. Richard and Linda are the parents of the young man who has shot the other children. Reed Birney and Anne Dowd are the two actors here. And the first voice that we'll hear here, I think, is that of Richard, played by Reed Birney.
I didn't mean to offend.
Oh.
I just think that we find through blame our means to change. And I want to question that. I want to look at everything because I blame myself. And I can't change that.
What do you mean?
I can't.
When you say that, what do you mean when you say that?
I can't change what I've done.
So you blame yourself? I'm asking, do you blame yourself?
Yeah.
No, I want to know. I didn't come here to talk fucking politics. You know? I want to know.
We don't want to interrogate.
I can imagine how hard it is to live with his actions.
It is.
But our loss. Please just tell me, what do you mean by that? When you talk about blame on your part, I want to know what you're referring to.
There is nothing that wasn't covered in the depositions.
But I want to hear it now. We never filed against you. We never took part in any of that.
Maybe a better way than interrogating is to learn what we remember.
Fine. So, tell me what you remember. Tell me about your son.
What would you like to know?
Everything. I want to know everything.
Why?
Why do I want to know about your son? Because he killed mine.
That's Martha Plimpton as Gail. You also heard Jason Isaacs, Reed Barney and Anne Dowd in that scene from Mass. It reminded me, Ruth, and we were trying to remember the name of the film. The film was Carnage. The play was Gods of Carnage, wasn't it? And it was, again, a four-hander in a New York apartment this time, but it was, and the stakes were much lower. It was just a bullying incident in the playground, not a shooting incident where somebody was killed. Does it rise above? It doesn't have origins in the play, but does it rise above that into cinema at any point?
It does and it doesn't. I mean, it very much is indie film written all over it, and so you're not going to get the big scenes. And what I liked about it was, in fact, it's kind of resistance to being cinematic because it doesn't. It could have had the flashbacks. It could have flashed back to the killing very easily, and that would have made it much more cinematic. But it resisted that, and that would have made it more voyeuristic, I think, than having. These four people locked into a room, and it's a brave decision, but there's nothing. It's not boring, and it's not boring to look at because you're so absorbed in what is again a fantastic script. And it's interesting that we've got two films by two actor directors.
Yeah,
and I think that's the strength of both these films, Belfast and this, is that the director is so in tune with the actors.
Yeah, it is about performances here as well. Although there's a big change of style towards the end, without giving anything away to us, Michael.
Ruth was saying there about cinema, it not being cinematic, and I would agree that the first, say, hour, 70 minutes or so are very staid and very deliberate. The camera, I would say, doesn't even move. And then there's a very strange point in the middle of it, and I feel that the tone of the film doesn't change in terms of the emotions and the themes, but there's a fade-out, and then film comes back and it completely switches gear visually to this kind of fluid, moving, modern technique. And I'm not just saying that because I would notice it. The aspect ratio changes, the photography changes, but it doesn't...
Right.
It's possible this is in tandem with some sort of breakthrough of sorts, but I didn't notice it, and I found it very distracting.
All right.
It's the only thing I would say that I took away from it.
Overall, did it work for you, Michael, and stars?
Very much so. It's a seriously heavyweight film, and it's not for everybody, but as an examination of kind of tragedy, and it's really rewarding, particularly the last 10 minutes. And the performances are really pitch perfect, especially Anne Dowd. I'd give it 4 out of 5.
4 out of 5. What are you saying, Ruth?
Yeah, 4 out of 5 too. Really impactful. It's hard, but it makes its point.
All right, okay. Ruth Barton and Michael Pope speaking to us there about Mass, our final movie. Before that, Nightmare Alley and Belfast. 80 years ago today, January the 20th, 1942, a meeting was held in the outer suburbs of Berlin to draw up what was referred to as the final solution, the Nazi plan to exterminate the Jewish people. The 1C conference lasted all of 90 minutes and implemented the most catastrophic case of genocide history ever witnessed. In its wake, the German philosopher Theodor Adorno asked if it were possible to write poetry after Auschwitz. There have been many attempts, of course, within literature, music and cinema, addressing Europe's darkest days. And here to discuss how cinema has addressed the Holocaust is lecturer at the National Film School, Stephen Benedict. I suppose, Stephen, for many people, if you say the Holocaust and you start talking about cinema, people are going to think pretty quickly, I think, of Schindler's List.
Yeah.
But it's such an enormous subject. There's no way that any single film, even a three-hour film as Schindler's List is, can address it. Was Adorno right when he suggested that, art is simply not equipped to address the Holocaust?
That's a huge question. It's a really tough question, Sean. I don't wish to dodge it. So if I can just retreat to an unusual space, if I can, to begin with ancient Greece. And if you just go with me for a second on this, I'd like to begin with ancient Greek culture with that, because Greek culture is the first time in European history that there is a shift from the oral tradition to the written tradition. And in effect, that means that Greek mythology, literature and drama has had more influence on Western storytelling than any other culture. Okay, it's the basis, it's the cornerstone of Western storytelling. And in ancient Greece, the thing is that in ancient Greece, the theatre was regarded as a sacred space, a divine space. And for that reason, it was decreed that no violence could be depicted on stage. It all had to happen off stage.
So the messenger would come and tell you what had happened.
That's right.
Or
the
was happening.
The chorus, the Greek chorus, yeah. And so perhaps I think Adorno was referring to that or alluding to that, because ever since then, ever since the Greek tragedians, Western drama has grappled with, one of the questions of Western drama is, how do we depict violence? And, you know, since we're talking about cinema, because cinema is so visual, it is by its very nature, it can be very, very explicit. But thankfully, there are some filmmakers who understand that sometimes what you put on screen is not as important as what you keep off screen. And since we're talking about the Wannsee Conference, there was a movie made 20 years ago starring Kenneth Branagh. I think Colin Firth is in it, Stanley Tucci, and our very own Brendan Coyle. The film is called Conspiracy. And it uses the only surviving transcript of the Wannsee Conference, of the meeting at Wannsee. And so the dialogue is constantly citing and referring to the transcript, to the meeting itself. So in actual fact, what we see is the bureaucratic design of the Final Solution, but we never actually see anything of the Holocaust. Because the thing was, by January 1942, the Holocaust was already well underway. There were massacres, there was deportations happening right across Europe. So the thing, my point here is, for a film like Conspiracy, the horrors are left off screen, and what's off screen is the genocide.
But there's a kind of verbatim theatre or verbatim film quality to what you're saying, in that we're getting the minutes of that.
Absolutely.
Appalling meeting, but that we're getting those given directly to us. How soon after the war did filmmakers, you know, start to say, right, this is something we can address? Because clearly time helps give some kind
perspective.
Of perspective.
Yeah. In 1946... Orson Welles made a movie called The Stranger, and that was about, it was a thriller, and it was about the hunt for a Nazi fugitive on the run in America. And what Welles did was, he took the very, very strong step of incorporating documentary footage of the Nazi concentration camps. But as I said, it's a thriller, so it's not really directly addressing the Holocaust. The earliest film to directly depict the Holocaust was made 2 years later, in 1948. It's a Polish film called The Last Stage. And I mentioned that for a number of reasons, not least of which it had a very, very big influence on Steven Spielberg when he went to make Schindler's List. But The Last Stage is remarkable in a number of ways. If I can list them, one, it was made by Holocaust survivors. Okay. Wanda Jakubowska and Gerda Schneider, they'd been prisoners in Auschwitz-Birkenau. And so they bring their very first, their eyewitness experience, their own testimony to the film. The second thing is that Jakubowska then cast other survivors of Auschwitz in the film. And this is most remarkable of all, Sean, for me. She actually made the movie in Auschwitz itself. She was given clear clearance to film in the death camps. And what I find remarkable about it is that she was allowed to film anywhere. But the one place she chose not to film, the one thing she did not go near, was the gas chamber. And that, I think, brings us back to ancient Greece and the theatre and the sacred space. There's something very, very sacred and also too obscene about going near the gas chambers.
Yeah. Well, and that is where you started talking about conspiracy, and how conspiracy had avoided that violence on screen, if you like, as well. Let's listen to a clip from Conspiracy. It's revealed here to the Nazi officials. It's appalling, the claustrophobic capability of the gas chambers.
Yes. Now, last summer, Reichsführer Himmler asked me to visit a camp up in Upper Silesia called Auschwitz, which is very well isolated and close to significant rail access. And we are turning that camp into a major center, solid structures. And here's where your Jewish labor comes into play, Herr Neumann. The Jews haul the bricks, and they build the buildings themselves. And when the structures are complete, we expect to be able to process 2,500 an hour. Not a day. An hour.
And those numbers look a lot better.
2,500 an hour.
2,500?
At 24 hours a day, that is 60,000.
Appalling figures that are given to us there. Stanley Tucci as Adolf Eichmann in that clip from Conspiracy. Who else did we hear there, Stephen?
We heard Kenneth Branagh very, very briefly. He played Heydrich, who was the guy who was actually chairing the meeting. And I think you're absolutely right. When you can hear the complete astonishment in the pausing of 2,500 an hour. Mm. And it's on an industrial scale. The murders, as I said to you, it's on a scale that history had never seen before. It was just the machinery that they were organizing in the meeting.
And obviously that scale, the scale of the Holocaust was part of what led Adorno to make that famous statement of his regarding how art can grapple or not with genocide. But the Holocaust sadly is not the only case of genocide that we're talking about in terms of the human race.
No, it's certainly not the first, and tragically it hasn't been the last. But the term itself, you know, is quite modern. It was coined in 1944 by a Polish Jewish lawyer called Raphael Lemkin. And the interesting thing is that he was creating the term not to describe the atrocities that were being carried out by the Nazis across Europe. He was actually referring to the first case of genocide in the modern era, which occurred in World War I between April 1915 and 1917, when the Turkish troops murdered 1.5 million Armenian people. And that's a charge that the Turks still deny to this day. But Lemkin coined the term genocide to warn the world against Nazism, hoping that it would not be repeated. But as he said, genocide has happened before and since. So I think it's not a question of necessarily depicting genocide. It's who is telling the story, who's making the film. So take, for example, the Hollywood Western. You know, historians estimate that over 400-year period between 1500 and 1900, roughly 12 million American Native American Indians were murdered or displaced or deliberately exposed to disease with the sole purpose of causing their deaths. Yet almost every Western that you see, you can see them on television right now, on Channel 4 in the afternoons. These films either completely ignore the genocide of the Native American Indian, or they depict European settlers as benign immigrants.
Yeah.
And their presence is resented by the Sioux or the Pawnee or the tribes. Now, just to put it in very, very stark terms, in Irish case, an equivalent would be if someone were to make a movie about Oliver Cromwell and depict him as a gentleman trying to bring democracy to Ireland. I think that gives you an insight into how it would be like if you're a Native American Indian watching a Western.
Richard Harris played Cromwell, didn't he, back in the 70s? The film, it didn't come anywhere near Ireland.
For a reason.
Yeah, oh yeah. You can only imagine. The Western Hollywood has tried to mend its ways, I suppose, films like Soldier Blue, Dances with Wolves. Mm. Have they addressed things in any, or are there films from other areas, other regions and territories?
Well, that's a very good question. I think the important thing, as you were saying, is for either survivors or the descendants of survivors to tell their stories, to give their own histories. And for instance, if you go to Cambodia, there's a film director there called Rithi Pan. He's a survivor of the murderous Khmer Rouge regime. And he's made several documentaries about genocide. And it's his insight and his firsthand experience of it which elevates the material above practically everybody else's ability to examine it, because he's exploring it from so many subtle different vantage points. Another example is the Australian Film Commission. And they have a policy to highlight the suffering experienced by the First Nations people in Australia.
Yeah. Let's listen to a clip from that film. Rabbit Proof Fences is an Australian film directed by Philip Noyce, not from the First Nations, but white Australian. This is based on a true story, focuses on the Stolen Generations, which saw the abduction of Aboriginal children to be adopted by white families to eradicate the Aboriginal people from Australia. Again, official government policy we're talking about here, which lasted 60 years.
Now, time and again, I am asked by some white man, if I marry this coloured person, will our children be black? And as chief protector of Aborigines, it is my responsibility to accept or reject those marriages. Here is the answer. Three generations. Half-blood grandmother, quadroon daughter, octoroon grandson. Now, as you can see, in the third generation, or third cross, no trace of native origin is apparent. The continuing infiltration of white blood finally stamps out the black colour. The Aboriginal has simply been bred out.
Kenneth Branagh getting quite an outing on the programme this evening, it has to be said, but they're a very nasty character. A.O. Neville, the Chief Protector of Aborigines, was his title, Orwellian in and of itself, I think you would agree, Stephen. And again, the sheer, the monstrosity of the machine is very evident there.
Yeah, it's the bureaucracy of it. And it's institutionalised and it's legislated by governments and it's carried out by the culture and then it's enacted by common civilians. You know, so the thing is, watching films like that, it gives us a very, very... I think it's the subtleties of those films that give us the
insight. Any other particular films, just say in 15 or 20 seconds that you might recommend to us?
That's a tough one. I'd recommend a Polish film called Ida. It's about a young woman becoming enter a convent to become a nun. She discovers she's actually Jewish, not Catholic. Her parents were murdered. And the second one I would recommend from last year is called Covadis Aida. It's available on Netflix. It's about the massacre in Srebrenica of the 8,000 Bosniak men and boys at the hands of the Serbian troops.
Stephen Benedict on a genocide in cinema. And that is our lot for this Thursday evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Michelle Gibson was the broadcast coordinator. Mark McGrath was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Olin McGowan. And now I won't be with you tomorrow or Monday, taking a couple of days off. Keith Sheehy will be in the seat. But I will be back with you on Tuesday. Really looking forward to launching Temple Bar Tradfest. Great programme. Stephen Ray, patron of the festival, will be with us here in studio. We'll have an interview with Peggy Seeger, who's playing next week at Tradfest. And we'll also have Steve and Joe Wall of The Stunning. Much more besides. That's on Tuesday evening. So until then, I will bid you farewell.